Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
In 2005, singer Will Oldham and guitarist Matt Sweeney released the Superwolf album, which has developed a cult following that includes Rick Rubin, who absolutely fell in love with the project. Now, 16 years later, they're back with the follow-up, Superwolves.
Other folks will make mistakes and leave you with a mess. Other folks have ways of walking past, but you know best. They're lost to begin with.
This new album was 5 years in the making. A leisurely pace that allowed Oldham and Sweeney to be incredibly intentional with their creative choices. Oldham, who's recorded under a number of different monikers in the past, including Bonnie Prince Billy, wrote all of the lyrics before sending them over to Sweeney to write his guitar parts. The duo also added a new flavor, tapping the West African musician Mdou Mokhtar to play guitar on a few tracks. On today's episode, Rick Rubin talks to Oldham and Sweeney about their work together, which Rick considers some of his favorite contemporary music, and it's also why he's used Sweeney on a lot of the sessions he's produced, including the Dixie Chicks, Cat Stevens, and Adele. Will Oldham talks about his philosophy on connecting with his audience, and how if this pandemic were to take us all, Superwolves would be a great album to go out on.
This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond.
Here's Rick Rubin with Will Oldham and Matt Sweeney.
How are we being graced with a new Superwolf project all this time since the last one?
Matt and I thought it could be a good idea. We didn't think about it till too late, but it could be a good idea to get up to speed with your conversational style in this forum. So I was listening a little bit earlier today to a conversation that you were having with Adam Cohen. You were saying that you just can't control it. You can't control, he says specifically, that a record isn't a fait accompli, and he has a beautiful little French-Canadian accent when he says it. And he, you know, and he goes on to say, even with the right songs and the right producer and the right blah, 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 you know, you can't guarantee. And you say, yeah, you can't, there's no, and I feel like if you just do something like take your time, you can kind of get close to guaranteeing it. So to answer your question, we just took a little bit of time. We wanted to make a good record. As you've probably experienced, most records that you probably feel strongly about, whether you participated in them or not, something did just happen, of course, that made them specifically rise above the other records. But having been aware of that, if you have the leisure, because you're doing other things, to build something slowly and just be sure that you only act when the charge is there.
Absolutely. Would you say in the writing process, do you consider the audience or not at all?
Yeah, no, it's all about the audience.
Like entirely.
Yeah, the whole reason to sit down and write is for the audience.
Interesting. It's probably less than 50-50 that would be the answer to people who write songs.
Yeah, you never hear people say that. I feel like Chuck Berry is the kind of person who would say it. He would be 100%. He would be a little colder in the way that he phrased it. But if you read about him talking earlier in his career, he's less harsh. But yeah, people don't say that.
I had a revelation recently that I'll share with you, which is I've always worked towards this idea of greatness, and I didn't know what greatness was, but that was the feeling. It's like it's not about selling a lot. It's not about making anybody else like it. It's about it has to be great. It has to be great in a way where it stands up to the test of time and it's forever. And it's like the bar was higher. And recently, I've come to realize that actually we're making art as an offering to God. And if you're making art for God, there are no shortcuts to take. There are no low vibration energies involved in the process. It's like that's what we're really aiming for, is this a sharing on a different plane, really.
I like to think that in what we do, or at least what I do, the offering is not the work. The offering is the connection made between the work and the audience, you know. My mother was a visual artist. Nobody ever saw her visual art. It's great. But she, I would maybe say that those could be considered offerings to God because they weren't shared with anybody. So in and of themselves, that's what they were. But because our labor goes to making a connection, you know, you're asking for an audience, you know, for to have any degree of success, whether it's financial or spiritual or artistic, there does need to be some sort of a connection to a recipient. And so the connection itself, building a connection that you feel that is sturdy or beautiful or complex, that's the offering that you're, rather than the piece itself.
I've noticed, at least in the context of Superwolf, particularly the first album, there are lyrics that I find they pull me in emotionally, and then there'll be, I'll call them surprises, certain landmines lyrically that you might not be expected in a song that sounds like these songs sound. Intentional? Unintentional?
Definitely intentional. I wish I could pull examples from my brain. I can think of songwriters like John Prine or Bob McDill, who wrote a lot of songs that Don Williams ended up playing, where... Do you know Don Williams' music at all?
A little bit.
You know, Good Old Boys Like Me, that song, where he says, I ran with a kid down the street who, you know, got himself something like burned up on bourbon and speed. And of course, in the chorus, when he says those Williams boys, and he says Hank in Tennessee, and it still is always like something to marvel at. It's still a surprise, and it keeps me coming back. That song sounds like something. You turn it on and it sounds exactly like what it sounds like. And then lyrically, he keeps confounding the sound of the song. I don't know. I feel all of a sudden I know I'm at home here. It's not, you know, this is where I belong. I belong in this thing that's a little more convoluted or labyrinthine but it's very friendly to you. It's very open and loving, and because it sounds like something that you love right away. But if it only was something simple like that, like a Farrah Fawcett poster or something, you would lose interest after a little while. Instead, it has a little bit of creepiness or a little bit of gore in there that keeps you on your toes and remembering that when the song starts again, you have the sense memory of this sounds pretty good, but it's actually even better than it sounds because the lyrics are going to take me someplace that the music is belying.
Great. Do songs typically start with a concept or a lyric? What's your way in typically?
I like triggers. For the past few years, my wife has done something for me, which I need to get her to do again. Is I put a piece of paper on the wall, and every day I just ask her to write a song title on that piece of paper. And then that just gives me something to sit down and stay in shape with. And every once in a while, something like, I think the song My Blue Suit, that's on this new record, it was a Elsa title song where she just wrote My Blue Suit. But then there's three songs on this record where I think up at the end of the street there was a bookstore, and the guy would be able to buy Overstock. There was a buyer who bought Overstock, and he curated his Overstock, you know, super discount new book selection amazingly. And he put on the table one day this book called Falkland Road, which is about Mumbai red light district. And it's just kind of one picture per two pages, and then a little, maybe a sentence or two sentences or three sentences that could be a quote from an interview with one of the people who's in the photograph. And there's three songs from this record that came, like, and I was just sharing those with, because I hadn't shown them to Matt until just like yesterday, right, Matt?
Well, you hadn't shown them like that. I'd seen that photo, the Good to My Girls photo. I know I'd seen
Good
that
to
before.
My Girls, yeah.
Yeah, I'd seen that just at your house, I guess, sitting around or something. Is that, I mean,
right, yeah. Right, yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And Rick, I almost sent you these pictures as pre-production, but then I said, fuck pre-production. But I thought that was a really fascinating way in and kind of an insight into how Will writes words, which is, you know, like you look at a photograph, for example.
Do you mind if we listen to a song? Could we listen to Good to My Girls?
Yeah, Good to My Girls, yeah.
We all have ways to make it seem we are not hard or bad. And I chop down trees and spit in faces and laugh when you are sad. Your happiness means almost less than all that's in the world, and my existence is okay, I guess, because I'm good to my girl. Share of life and earth, and they may cry.
Beautiful song.
Thanks, Rick.
So the line that the woman says is, I'm good to my girls. I take them to the movies once a month. Business is bad now, but I still buy good food. I spent 750 rupees for clothes for Christmas.
When I heard the song, I thought for sure it was an autobiographical song.
Well, it is. That's the thing.
I thought it was you talking about your wife. I assumed you had either a daughter or more than one, and you were talking about being good to your girls, and then you get to the hard part, and that's more like self-reflection, concerns you have about yourself might not even be true, more like obsessive thoughts of not being good enough. It's just interesting. Like that's what I heard. It was like, oh, this one's really about him.
Well, I mean, there's no other source from which to truly draw to get a multidimensional lyric. So that it comes from, you know, that's the idea, is that it comes, and triangulating, I can triangulate with this madam in order to make something that I can sing, hopefully, again and again and again and again and again and again, and still engage. And then also an audience member can hear it again and again and again. And it comes from, you know, documenting a shared experience rather than a unique experience.
What would be other lyrical influences for you historically?
Danzig. We've talked about this, Rick, but Danzig, yeah. I mean, Danzig, huge. I mean, he's huge. And still, like, I understand that he was, you know, virtually a child when he wrote a lot of the, you know, the lyrics that he wrote in the 80s. And yet I get so excited by the potential energy that's wound up in his lyrics. They're just so incredible and so beautiful that I always think, well, that's something to continue to aspire to. Because if it, you know, too many writers write better as children than they do as adults, which is, I think, an absolute sin that it's allowed to happen, you know, that the songwriters themselves allow it to happen and that people in the world allow it to happen as well. That we don't ask more of our senior lyricists or senior singers, expect more from them rather than, oh, this is as good, you know, or comparing them to the past.
Yeah.
Talking about all this stuff, can you devote like 35 to 40 seconds around the phenomenon of Glenn Danzig writing the song for Roy Orbison?
Sure. Had an opportunity to do a song with Roy Orbison, and I could find, you know, I could cast any writer, and I knew that Glenn loved Roy, and I knew that he wrote great songs, and I knew that he would write a different song than anyone else who might write a song for Roy Orbison would write, and I wanted to hear what that was. And he wrote the song he wrote, and we went and we played it for Roy, me, Glenn, and Roy. I remember we went to Roy's house in Malibu, and Glenn played him the song, and he loved
it. Did Glenn just play it live for him, like played it with a guitar?
I think so. I think he did.
Yeah.
I can't really remember, but I think he did.
Yeah.
And then...
So sick.
And he's like, okay, I'm in. Let's do it.
Yeah. But that takes a lot of... I mean, that's a nice, beautiful, complicated relationship to voice and melody and connecting to artists who are... makes so much sense. And also Glenn's song on the first American record is... that's, I think it's my favorite song on the... because he's so good. He's so brilliant at... but knowing... I mean, you have to understand, you have to have a pretty deep understanding of what a lyric is, Rick, to take that risk, to know that it's a risk that's going to pay off, because most people would laugh at you. You know, I wouldn't laugh. You know, when we were kids and we heard this legend that Glenn had just, you know, was working with Roy Orbison, we, you know, it took us a year before we realized it was the truth. It sounded so ridiculously far-fetched and perfect. But you had to have an understanding of like, oh, well, this guy understands how to build a song lyrically as well as melodically. And he probably studied under these masters. And so I can put him in the same room with these guys and everything's going to be just fine.
It's also interesting. This leads back to something we were talking about earlier about people doing great work when they're young. We had the elder statesman in Roy who could still do what Roy does. And we had the
performatively,
yeah. And we had the young energy of Glenn Danzig, like prime songwriting. And it, and I guess you could say the same thing's true for Trent Reznor and Hurt with Johnny. It's like, even though when Johnny sings it, it sounds like he wrote it. It sounds like he's telling his story, but the fact that it's written by, you know, a 22-year-old kid in his bedroom. It's just fascinating.
Yeah.
It's fascinating how that works.
Yeah.
Or I See a Darkness in Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
Same deal. I've always wanted to see the two of you guys together and ask about that scenario, which was Rick, I saw you at a party. I just gotten back from a European tour with Will, and we had a bonus show in New York, and I knew that you had been in contact with you would ask for some Will records because you were working with Johnny Cash. You were interested in him checking out Will's music. I had that intel. So I went up to you, invited you to the show, and you were enthusiastic and you went to the show, and then you guys could take over from there just about how it came to pass that Johnny Cash ended up doing one of Will's songs.
Well, I didn't remember I didn't remember meeting you at a party.
Yeah.
I didn't remember coming to the show, although I did remember seeing you in New York. Will at where was it?
Bowery Ballroom.
Yeah, and it was a mesmerizing show. It was a mesmerizing show. It was a mind blowing show.
And then I think that's where you said that you all had cut the song and you said if I wanted to come out and or come to a session and play the piano part on it that was something that was needed for the song and I agreed and we exchanged numbers. And then a couple of days later, I called you and left a message admitting that I didn't know how to play the piano and asking if I could. I think I said just that I had no expectations, but the only if there was any way that I could be around John and June for any moments, because they were, you know, together and separately heroes. And it's so rare, you know, because of so many bizarre communication and other logistical walls, it's so rare for younger musicians to have access to their heroes. And so here's this little crack. And I was just like, if I could, you know, yeah, you, I had your ear. And if I could just sit and watch them do something working, and you were kind enough to say, yeah, okay.
We'll be right back with more from Will Oldham and Matt Sweeney.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented 3 new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at marketmessage2024.com right now. Again, the link to watch is marketmessage2024.com. That's marketmessage2024.com.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
We're back with Rick Rubin, Will Oldham, and Matt Sweeney.
How did you guys meet?
On the street. via our friend Britt Walford, the drummer from Slint.
And Britt and I grew up together, yeah. But it was when, like, the I See a Darkness record, my brother and some other musicians and I had started a smaller record label than Drag City, to put out a few records, including I See a Darkness. And since we were in many ways starting from scratch, I moved to the big city to hire a publicist and just to be more present for the delivery of this record than. Because I just knew I needed to be, just to figure out, well, how do you put a record out? And so I was in New York, and that's when we started to become friends.
Tell me about the choice of recording under different names.
For a long time, I thought, you know, records why not file them under the title of the record? Because they are such, you know, oftentimes such different and distinct entities. And they, you know, it can be completely like it could be the same artist, but there's nobody else except for the artist, the art, you know, quote unquote artist, that's the same from another record. So why not just say it's a record? It's this record. And so for just a few years in the 90s, in when I was trying to figure out what it was to make music and write songs and make records, just thought, well, I don't, you know, for me, I just want to make records. I don't want to create an artist persona or an artist name or a band or anything like that. I just want to make a record, you know, keep making records. And thought, well, if I modify the name a little bit just to reflect that you should be focusing on the record and not on anything else, it turned out, you know, I learned in a few years just the model was too foreign to how things work, and people started to, you know, say, well, what's up with the names? And it's like, no, that was the opposite. You know, it's what, you know, so I realized like, oh, well, just come up with a name and then forget about it. So just came up with the name Bonnie Prince Billy, and just, it doesn't mean anything. It's just a way for distributors and, you know, streaming services to, you know, organize things.
From the outside, it seemed like you were doing whatever you could to have people not find your work. That's what it seemed like. I never, it just like, why? Well, I guess he doesn't want us to hear it.
Because we want people to find it not based on a name.
Yeah.
You know, based on, you know, based on, do you, oh, hearing it on the radio or a friend saying, I like this song. Do you like this song? Yes, I like this song. And not like, oh, I'm so into fucking, you know, whatever, the birthday party. It's like, okay. That's cool.
That said, I'm so into the birthday
party. Or I'm so into the Rolling Stones. And you just be like, okay, well, you know, yeah, Bridges to Babylon. Insane record, dude. But, you know, yeah, so just, you know, have it be as much about the music as possible. That was it. And just have it not be, as, you know, as little bullshit as possible so that when you go to play shows, you know, you don't have a bunch of, you know, people who don't care where they are. They care where they are. They, you know, you have a room full of good energy.
It's a wild choice.
You know, Rick, I when I met Will, so we had a friendship through our friend Britt, but then in the office, I asked him the same question because he had just made this record, Colossi of Darkness, and he was calling himself Bonnie Prince Billy. And so I remember, like, I was actually sitting behind a desk and I was like, dude, why are you calling it Bonnie Prince Billy? And I remember, Will, you go, I'm trying to alienate my fan base.
It worked.
Yeah. No, it didn't work. Because I was kidding. You know, because the opposite happened. I mean, the idea is just like, so that now I can still, we can go play shows and I can look forward to meeting people, which I do.
Yeah.
Because there was a consistency.
Because people are there, not because of, you know, whatever. They're there because they're anticipating that they may witness some music that's going to do something for them.
Do you remember when you each heard the other one for the first time?
Yeah, I knew Will's recorded music and I'd seen him play live. But yeah, it happened really quickly. Like Will came over to where me and Britt were staying and I had a guitar and I was dicking around on it. And Will said, oh, that sounds really good. and then we were recording a few days later.
Recording a few days later for what?
There's a French film director named Bertrand Bonello, and he had made he was making a movie called Quelques Choses d'Organique, and he wanted to... I think he wanted to license a song that I had recorded, and I said, I don't like to license songs, but if you would consider commissioning a song, I'd like to, you know, I'd love to write a song, you know, and you know, if you have the time to do that. And he bit. So he, you know, I told me the story and gave us a time frame, and that's right when Matt picked up his guitar and I was working on this song and just said, I'm supposed to record this song sometime in the next couple of weeks. Are you down?
And it was interesting. It was kind of around the time that I feel like turned a corner on guitar and I could sort of confidently finger pick and I had kind of made a leap in playing guitar, come to think of it, actually. But like I had sort of gotten finger picking down right when I met you, Will.
Yeah, it felt new to you, like you were really writing it. Yeah, it was really exciting.
Matt, what had you done already in music at this point when you met Will?
When I met Will, I had already done Chavez, which was my 90s rock band, which still maybe we'll play again. So I'd done that and it had been slowing down. The other band members were moving on with their lives and stuff. So I was, I actually had some time and was sort of in a space of not having my regular band to play with. And I sang for that band, and that band was very much of a collaborative kind of thing. And then all of a sudden I kind of didn't have as much to do, and I'd been finger picking and stuff. And it was fortuitous that I met like a good singer who shared a lot of the same tastes in music that I did and whose songs I liked, which is Will.
And you played and sang?
Me, yeah.
I didn't know that you sang.
Come on, dude.
Had no idea.
You didn't, really?
Had no idea.
I had a really exciting moment, Rick. I was opening on a tour for Bjork, and there was a couple days off, and I wanted to see, and we were in the New York area, so I went out to Montauk because I wanted to see it. I'd never been there. And, you know, got a motel room, and I went to the gas station. They had DVDs for rent, and I rented a DVD to watch a movie in my little motel room. And it's a movie about, it's a sort of a comedy, a meth comedy, you know, a crystal meth comedy called Spun. And I just put it on, and this, you know, the opening song comes on. It's really cool sounding. It sounds fucking great. And just the music sounds great. And then, and it's guitars. And then this voice comes on, and I'm like, oh, I know this voice. I know that this song's so cool. It's so good. It's so effective. I know this voice, but I couldn't figure out what it was, and I had to wait to the end credits. And it turns out it was Sweeney singing a cover of Iron Maiden's Number of the Beast with the sort of acoustic version of the Zwan band that he was a part of back in the early 2000s.
Amazing.
Yeah. Was it just the two of you?
It was just me playing guitar and Corrigan kind of licking. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really a sweet sounding song, and the vocals are awesome. So as soon as that you know discontinued, the first thing that I think either of us did musically when Zwan ended was get together and make the Superwolf record.
Wow.
Yeah. What had happened was the Zwan stopped playing kind of in the middle of a tour. All of a sudden I was back in New York, and Will wrote and said, "Hey, I have a solo show booked at a big venue in London. Would you want to maybe come and, you know, I'll come over there and you could play a couple of songs and stuff." And there was a tacit understanding that I was kind of screwed, I think, on Will's part. So it was a nice offer for something for me to effing do. And I said, yes. And then he wrote an email and said, challenge. And he said, "Hey, how about I send you some lyrics and you write some songs and we play them at that show?" So I said, okay. And so then he sent the lyrics to
What Are You, Beast for Thee, and Bed Is for Sleeping.
Yeah. And so that was the beginning of Superwolf. So I have these lyrics, you know, and I have to write a song to play in front of like 3,000 people in London in like a month or something like that.
Unbelievable.
And it's a challenge when somebody says that. It's kind of terrifying, you know what I mean? But then at the same time, it made me respond, you know, and getting these incredible lyrics and then being like, holy shit, this guy thinks I'm good enough to do this. And then that maybe do good work.
Do you guys mind if we listen to The Beast in Me?
A Beast for Thee?
I'm sorry. Wrong song.
Let's do it.
Plan can easy bruise
One bone and blood mass we fuse, and I can be a beast for thee.
So hearing that, it just makes me wonder, why do you guys ever make music apart?
In order to make that.
Yeah.
I mean, the joy of collaboration is comes from accessing somebody else's world. And if you're already full-time accessing that person's world, it's the joy is, going out and doing things and then coming back together and saying, back. This is what I got. Oh, yeah, well, this is what I got. Oh, no, you also have this.
Amazing.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I was thinking when I was listening to that, I was like, God, it really is cool how this music sounds. The record that's coming out sounds like this record that's 16 years old. Like, it's all one thing. But I was thinking that the reason that this record, that the new record is good, has a lot to do with experiences that I had with you, Rick, just as far as like being thrown so many curveballs in high pressure situations, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, dude, I had no idea what I was doing. I told you the first time that I met you, Rick, I was like, thanks. I don't know what do I do? I don't know what I'm doing. And you had this really empowering line. You know, I was like, so this is, we were recording Johnny Cash songs. We were recording just to a click track and Johnny Cash's voice, and it's Tom Petty's band, and I'm the new guy. And it's Tom Petty's band plus Smokey Hormel, who's like the world's greatest guitar player, and then it's me. And Rick had invited me into this group, and I was like, do I like just make up stuff like what I would do normally, like just kind of make up stuff, like what if that's not appropriate? And you go, Rick says, you're isolated. We could just hit a race.
Did I really say that? Like,
yes.
That's really funny.
But what was so great? It was a great thing because I was like, it totally made.
Yeah, have fun.
You know, it made me feel
have
really,
fun.
Really free. And also, I think you said, you do you, like do what you want to do. You're isolated. We could always hit a race. And then he kind of gave a devilish smile. But like, that was a really big deal. You know, just even that was like, oh, right. You know, like, I definitely felt like going back in with Will was like, okay, I could get to where we need to go quicker. And I feel way more sure-footed and stuff. And also, I'm really grateful that I had the time to stumble around in the dark and be terrified and have all these experiences that led, like, I can't sound the way that I sound now without having all this crazy, you know, face plants and successes and just general high wire terror that you provided me with. So thanks.
Well, the reason you were there was to do what you do. That's the only, like, if it was just to have someone play guitar, there's a lot of people who play guitar, but I wanted Matt Sweeney to play guitar. And the only reason you want Matt Sweeney to play guitar is because he plays like Matt Sweeney.
Yeah. It's so cool how Matt Sweeney plays like Matt Sweeney.
Just like him. It's amazing. It's ridiculous.
It's exciting to be in the recording studio and to hear, you know, to hear it, you know, going down on tape or what passes for tape right now, is just to hear it and just think, wow. There it is. It's right there.
It's really
right
funny that you had that moment renting a DVD and hearing a voice and wondering who it was and it being Matt, and me listening to the Superwolf album and hearing that guitar and going, who is that? And both of us came to Matt. It's interesting that, like, for you, the vocal was the spark. For me, the guitar was the spark. But it definitely came from not knowing what we were listening to. To like, whoa, this, and to hear something that you don't know what it is and to care enough about finding what it is a really big deal. That doesn't happen.
That's a really big deal.
It doesn't happen so often, especially in the pre-Shazam days. It was really a job to make that happen.
Now, I was talking to someone about the first time I heard the Sean Marshall Cat Power, and it was on the radio in Virginia somewhere, and it was a woman singing this exploded, deconstructed version of Hank Williams' I Can't Help It If I'm Still in Love With You. And it took me months of asking people, you know, I heard this song. You didn't, no, I don't know what you're talking about. And they would give me these stupid ideas of who it could have been. No. You don't know what I'm saying. It's this crazy thing. It's, you know, and it, months. Yeah. And now it is a little easier.
We'll be back after a quick break with Will Oldham
and Matt Sweeney.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented three new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. He put everything you need to know in a new presentation specifically designed for people off Wall Street. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at newstocktrend.com right now. Again, the link to watch is newstocktrend.com. That's newstocktrend.com.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
We're back with the rest of Rick Rubin's conversation with Will Oldham and Matt Sweeney. But before we jump back in, let's hear some of their new song, My Popsicle.
We crawl towards a warmthless light, towards a wild and endless night. My pop, my popsicle, my popsicle, my popsicle, made by your square once was dark and wild and frightening to a guileless child. My pop, my popsicles, my popsicles, my popsicles, made by your mom and me.
Wow. The music you guys make is, I could literally listen to it forever. It's unbelievable. It's like, I might like listening to your music more than any other music. So it really is ridiculous I feel like I'm the audience. You're making it for me.
It is ridiculous. It's ridiculous, but I think that some of that is, you know, when we had this sequenced and then mastered, my brother Paul mastered it, and my wife and I, you know, one evening were ready to listen to the master and listen to it all the way through. And throughout the record, I was listening to it. I was crying sometimes and I was laughing a whole lot. And, you know, my wife asked, you know, she's like, why are you laughing? And it's hard to fully explain, but part of it is gratitude for the way that it came together, because it ended up coming together in such a way that it is the things that records have done for me is not something that's easy to find. It felt good to have participated in making a record that has this kind of content, musical and lyrical content, and that it's worth sitting with it song after song. And I think I kept laughing because I would remember where I was in the record and think, oh, this part still hasn't happened. And I feel like this, and this part is still going to happen. And I feel like this. It's been a long time since I've been carried away by a new record, I guess. It's funny in this year, this crazy year where everyone's perception is so different, but just feeling like, wow, it's not a bad record to, you know, if a plague takes us, you know, I feel okay about this being the record that we ended things with.
It's really a beauty. It's a beauty.
Thank you, Rick.
Anything different in the process between making this album and the first album 16 years ago?
Yeah. We had a Tuareg band. On the Superwolf record, the only outside musician is Pete, right?
Yeah.
It's Pete Townsend, the drummer. You know, so it was that. It was insular. And then with this one, which is pretty interesting, that the way that this record got kickstarted was Will and I had done a recording session with Mdou Mokhtar, who, Rick, have you checked him out yet?
Mm-mm.
Oh my God, you're going to fucking lose your mind. Okay, so Mdou Mokhtar is a Tuareg guy, like Tino Irwin. He's from
Niger, yeah.
Yeah, he's from Niger, he's from the desert, and he's an explosive, mind-blowing musician. And we got a chance to use him and his band on a song that Will and I had already written. And the song was actually like had a lot of parts and a lot of this and that to it. And these guys nailed it, which is pretty wild because they're not like trained musicians. They play a very specific style. But because we had such an incredible connection with these guys, and particularly like that they seemed to actually vibe. I mean, they clearly vibed with how Will sang and how I played guitar. Like we meshed, and that was exciting and definitely exciting enough because Will and I had already been writing songs with the idea of recording, but this was enough for Will to be like, well, I guess we should probably use them as a band, you know, and try writing, like, maybe this is the way we start the Superwolf record, just like use this mind-blowing band and see what happens. And so we did.
Yeah, we had a fantastic recording session with them on another unrelated song. And or everybody at the end of the day, you know, it's one of those days in the recording studio where everybody's glowing at the end of the day. And you just think, we'd like to do this again sometime. Oh yeah, we would too. Let's do it again. You know, so it was just up to when they were going to come back to the United States of America. And when they did, you know, we said, well, if you've got a few extra days in New York, can we book a session? And we'll go back in and do more. And then, so we knew we had to get our act together by then. Yeah.
Yeah. And the songs that we recorded in that session, one was a composition that came together with all of us in a room, which is also like very, very, very different than everything else. Which is
everything. Yeah. Every like the night before the session, you know, the afternoon before the session, the song didn't exist in any way, shape or form. And then that night we all got together in an apartment and everything, all of the music, all of the lyrics, all the melodies, everything came together that night. And then we tracked it.
And as far as like the power of like music connecting, just the town that they live in is a 28-hour bus ride to the nearest airport. Okay, so these guys are from a different place, you know. So you know, the connection, it felt good, you know, and so we came up with a song together, and then we also got to use them on songs that we had written before. We were pretty conscientious about what the other songs were, you know, like sort of taking advantage of using these musicians. For example, the song "I'm a Youth," which is an Irish traditional Irish song.
Well, again, addressing the differences between the MDU's on that. But the first record we did it, you know, we spent probably up to a year putting the songs together. Then we went in it for a week, tracked and mixed in Shelbyville, Kentucky. One session, the two of us, my brother Paul engineering, our friend Pete playing drums. This time, you know, we wrote over the course of 5 years and did it in two sessions, one in New York and then the other in Nashville with Ferg, and then the MDU Mokhtar ensemble playing on the New York thing. So those are the significant differences in how the record itself was, the two records were made.
So check out Hall of Death. I mean, as far as like just as an example, this is what happened when we got together with these gentlemen from a very different place.
You know, we put this song out as a single a few weeks ago, right? And people have talked about it, and there's been a positive response to it, right? There has been, as far as anything that I've heard from anybody, I haven't heard Word One mentioning the fact that there are lyrics to the song, much less what the lyrics are. You know, in general, it's interesting that people don't really listen to lyrics. You know, most people will say, I don't even listen to the lyrics. You know, that's what the streaming model is built around, is people not listening to lyrics. Like when we made the song in the recording studio, we tracked it all live except for the lead guitar. And that's MDU's guitar. And for some reason, I can't remember if he was, I think he had a friend of his had like died in an automobile accident in Africa. And so he was on the phone and, you know, he was so overwhelmed with grief. He couldn't play with us, so we played. And then I think 2 days later, we like, you know, would you play on this song? And he's sitting there to go into play. And we're all sitting there. I'm sitting on the floor at his feet. And Matt says, well, you know, to help MDU, why don't you explain, you know, what the song is about? And I'm taken aback because, you know, I didn't have this. I wrote the lyrics on 3 days before. And so I didn't filter anything, you know, and it's essentially just about the horror and desperation of years of having, of my mom living in, you know, being incommunicado because of Alzheimer's disease and living in a nursing home and what it's like to go to her, you know, on a extremely regular basis. And so, okay, I'll fucking explain these lyrics. I'm not sure if it's going to help his guitar playing or not. We'll see, you know, with this song.
Because in the past, I've seen Will like be like, "Hey, the song's about this, so go like that." You know, I've seen you give that direction, or I had seen you go that direction before. So
yeah.
I'm thinking, and also I'm kind of curious because all I know, I think I knew, I don't know if I really heard, could hear any of the things because any of the actual words. I could hear the melody that he was singing. But everything was live. We recorded the song live. The vocal is live in a really loud room, you know. So I did not know what the words were. So I figured, you know, and you know, how is MDU gonna know what the words are anyway? So then Will says what the words are about, and it's shocking, you know.
And it spurs a conversation then, because Mdou begins to go into a tirade about how shitty Americans are to their elders. And, you know, I have a similar sense, you know, like the horror of visiting my mom, you know, a huge part of the horror of visiting my mom in this place is thinking like, what brought circumstances, you know, what brought this circumstance to happen that my mother, that I am a responsible human being, a functioning fucking responsible human being, and I don't have it, you know, I can't live a life and also take care of her. And there's not a support system to take care of her so that she can stay at home, you know. But he's, you know, basically like hammering everything that I felt shitty about in my life for the past 5 years and just saying, you suck. You fucking suck because this is who you are, yeah. You know. That's what I'm hearing, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then I eventually like have to leave. I'm so upset. I have to leave. And the session kind of falls apart that week. I don't sleep for days. Anyway, I hear it as like one of the strengths, I think, of my working with Matt is that he allows for a greater amount of vulnerability in the lyric and then also in the singing. And I hear nothing but this horrific vulnerability in that song. And so, and it's also, you know, I hear the electricity of the excitement of our collaboration with the ensemble from Niger. But it sits for me beautifully in the record because I, you know, because it's, you know, people say like, oh, it's this propulsive rock song, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, to me, it's this, you know, really hard song about how we, what do you do about the fact that, you know, that you are of the guilty mistreating children in these death institutions, you know, these institutions that are built around, you know, allowing people to die ignored.
Heavy jam.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Heavy jam. Anything else you guys feel like we should talk about? Anything that would be helpful or interesting?
I think we did good. You're really good at this, Rick.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Lots of love.
Thanks to Matt Sweeney and Will Oldham for talking about their creative collaboration with Rick. To hear Superwolves along with our favorite Bonnie Prince Billy songs, head to BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find new and old episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Martin Gonzalez, Eric Sandler, and Jennifer Sanchez. With engineering help from Nick Chafee, our executive producer is Mia LaBelle. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. And if you like the show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Peace.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented 3 new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at marketmessage2024.com right now. Again, the link to watch is marketmessage2024.com. That's marketmessage2024.com. MuseAura is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of MuseAura, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today. Hello, hello, Malcolm Gladwell here. Are you a fan of true crime podcasts? How about investigative reporting from award-winning journalists? If you are, then you'll want to tune in to the new content coming from Pushkin this summer that you can listen to early and ad-free. Our team has exciting new seasons from podcasts like Deep Cover, The Nameless Man, from Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jake Halpern, and Death of an Artist, Krasner and Pollock, the story of the woman behind painter Jackson Pollock's fame. Plus a new season of Lost Hills, Dark Canyon, which investigates the dark side of Malibu, California. And a brand new show coming in July called Where's Dia? About the sudden vanishing of a millionaire widow in California. You won't want to miss Pushkin's True Crime Spree coming this summer. And if you want to binge these shows early and ad-free, you can hear all of Pushkin's content by becoming a Pushkin Plus subscriber. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or by visiting pushkin.fm/plus.